Good afternoon, everyone. Hello. We can be here in, and we have Darby coming, etc. He's making a comedy or acting, I understand.
Yes, sorry, I'll present, I'll address the commissioners on the legal submissions for Darby Planning Limited. Mr. Ferguson is also the planner for the Henson Family Partnership, so his evidence has a section, a very small section on that, those provisions as well that are relevant to this round of hearings. And yes. I just thought to try and keep those two issues separate because they are quite separate. My colleague Ms. Hill will present legal submission to a couple of pages at the end for the Henson Family Partnership. So we'll come back like little bookends. Whereas I submitted a draft of my legal submissions on Friday, which I'm just thinking to talk to. I have added some bits to it since Friday, so I thought I'd hand out the latest version, just to highlight where I've added some things. So I'll go first, but I also suggest that if questions arise that it's of me, that it's helpful for Mr. Ferguson to answer at the same time, that we act as kind of a team rather than doing it in sequence. I think that might be more helpful to get all that information rather than just hearing from the lawyer and then asking the same question 20 minutes later.
That's fine. Can I also just clarify, I've got Jack's point on the list, that Mr. Ferguson's evidence covers that, but there's no legal representation of them, is that correct?
Oh, I act for Jack's point as well, yes.
So on the, just in terms of on the front cover, right. It just yep. Says Darby, Soho, Triple Cone.
Yes.
And then we turn over the page, there's a whole bunch of extra people.
That's so right.
Right.
What's the connection?
So the connection is that generally Darby Planning Limited put in a district-wide submission, and then various entities listed there are related entities to Darby Planning, who have also got submissions in their own right addressing their site-specific concerns, but they are tucking in behind the Darby Planning Limited district-wide submission as well, rather than repeating every district-wide issue that's relevant to greater or lesser degrees for each individual submitter. The theory was that Darby Planning Limited would address the district-wide provisions as a whole, as they relate to all of the related entities, and then those entities also have site-specific issues that are addressed in those individual submissions.
Right.
I think that is all set out in the start of the actual Darby Planning Limited submission itself. So one thing I just wanted to also note in respect of those entities listed out in 1.1, all of them except for Lake Hayes Limited and Lake Hayes Salmon Limited are either wholly within or partly within an O&L. So those provisions are relevant to most of those entities in quite different contexts for each one. So I'll give you my slightly more up-to-date submissions. And the first area where I've expanded on, which I've highlighted in grey, is I've just added in some more case law on about the, I call it the term, is the collective scope that the panel has got when it comes to making a decision that's more relevant to you because it's a case law in relation to plans rather than consent appeals. So it took from the Simon's Hill, Simon's Pass High Court decision, one of the cases referred to was an EBS case on a plan that the High Court judge referred to, and then that's been subsequently cited by Judge Harland sitting alone in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and she confirmed in that decision, which is quite a recent one, 2015, which I've got in my paragraph 1.5, that it confirms that the test is not about determining whether the policy, this was in respect of an appeal, the policy is named in the submission or appeal documents, but whether the amendments sought are reasonably and fairly raised in the course of the submissions. So just confirming that the collective scope that you've got is incredibly wide, and that as long as a submitter has, you know, generally raised a matter that's affected by a provision, whether or not that submitter has sought specific relief in respect of the provision, it does not prevent that submitter from advancing changes once all the other submissions are taken into account as well. So really just trying to make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of how the collective scope works at this hearing. Any queries in respect of that before I move on? Another thing I'd just like to emphasise on page 3 is generally that Derby Planning Limited and the related entities are quite supportive of the plan as notified. So whilst these submissions are all about things that we want changed, that shouldn't be taken as a general lack of support for the plan. We're focusing our energy on what change we want, but don't forget the big picture is that we think it's a good framework, it's very user-friendly, it's much more workable than the current plan, and there's general support for the direction it's heading in. Under the heading of diversification of the rural zone, I've just added to paragraph 3.1 the observation that neither Queenstown or Wanaka are rural service towns. They don't exist primarily to service a rural hinterland, which is obviously quite different to another district's. Like, say, you know, Gore is clearly a rural service town, and even someone argued that Invercargill is a city that has that role. The role of Wanaka and Queenstown has, part of its role is servicing the rural hinterland, but it's not its primary role. Its primary role and its character is something that's quite different. In paragraph 3.2, something in terms of the time frame over which you're going to stretch your minds about how this plan, how far this plan will influence into the future. There's actually two time frames that are touched on in these submissions. One is operationally and practically, this plan is likely to be used for the next 10 to 20 years. So even though technically it gets reviewed after 10 years, we know that as variations and plan changes come along, its actual practical life does extend out to 10 to 20 years. But that's different to its planning horizon. And there's the case law that we've cited earlier, Canterbury Regional Council in Christchurch, where the planning horizon and the future generations that you ought to have in mind when you make your decisions, and my submission is about two generations worth of future generations. So even though the life of the plan is only 10 or 20 years, the future generations that you ought to be considering is much longer than that, and that's the importance of what you're planning for here. Mr. Robinson, you look like you're getting ready.
It's like being poised. Don't let me stop you. Okay.
And under the urban development heading, you may have picked up.
Well, thank you. paragraph 3.4, that's the subject that was going to be my subject of my question. Are two thoughts put to you. The first is you're drawing a distinction between rural activities and farming.
Mm.
On Thursday, I asked Mr. Baxter, who's effectively the only landscape evidence giver, landscape expert giving evidence for the submitters, whether the character of the Wakatipu Basin was still rural. And he said it was.
Mm.
And so my question to you is, while you're taking a position that it's not farming, it's not farming character, is it too much of a stretch to say a rural character is something that looks like farming, even if it may not be? I previously asked witnesses whether this is the duck principle. If it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck.
Yeah.
It probably is a duck.
Mm.
In this case, it may not be a duck. but it may look like one.
Yes.
And is that is the appearance of farming an important element of the character of cooperative basin, being, I think, by general repute or general acceptance, certainly the area that's moved furthest from a what might call an extensive farming character.
Mm. I think, given that, so Mr. Baxter said yes, it is still of rural character.
Yes.
Right. Well, as you've observed, we haven't yet called a landscape witness. and we'll be doing so in the subsequent hearing rounds on a site by site, where it's relevant to some of the submitters, some of the data entities. Because I think at that more site specific level, that's where the weight, that's where the importance of the answer to that question comes from. So obviously some of our clients are ski field operators, so that's not farming, and don't think you'd call it rural either at the top of the mountain, so the answer to that question would be different there. Glendu Bay would currently appear to be rural and farming, but that has consented to change its use quite significantly. And the submission in respect of Glendu Bay is really to put into a plan context, a plan framework, that consented use, so that we don't have to mess around with lapsing and so on, primarily, and to get that certainty for the landowners.
Perhaps it's something that Mr. Ferguson can think about while he awaits our questioning.
Well, and the follow-up is, while I understand that you'll be producing landscape evidence, given that we have to decide, this panel has to decide the strategic chapters, presumably we should give particular weight to whatever landscape evidence we've heard on these strategic chapters.
Yes, although I had assumed that there was going to be still an iterative decision-making process as you worked your way through the hearing topics.
Well, that cannot be too iterative because only the panel members who have heard the submissions and evidence can make recommendations on that particular matter, and if they change, then, for instance, Commissioner Gilmore won't be sitting on the later ones this year. I'm not sure which ones Commissioner Cox is sitting on, but it's not rural.
Right, yeah.
Yes. Commissioner Robinson's not sitting on the rural.
Right.
So it does make a difference,
yes,
as to our position.
We'll put it another way, it might be now or never. So Mr. Burgess will ponder that one. Thank you. Well, the other question, general question, relates to your words, your comment in the last sentence of 3.4, inconsistent with the effects-based premise of resource management planning. Now I understand that generations of planners have been schooled on the basis that the RMA is an effects-based piece of legislation. Can you point me to any case that says that effects-based planning is the only premise of the RMA?
No.
Because there isn't one.
To be fair, I wasn't aware of one.
No, there isn't. But what we're saying here on this particular issue is that on the merits, taking an effects-based approach to managing the landscapes of the non-urban areas of the district is the most appropriate way to manage that resource. It's the most efficient way of doing it. It is what can be justified in terms of the important values and enabling landowners to make the most of their land without detracting from those important values. So yes, it's not restricted legally to taking an effects-based approach, and there's no precedent that says we must. but for the Queenstown Lakes District, at the strategic level, that's what we're submitting.
So, just to be clear, you wouldn't have an argument that an activity-based plan is open to panel to put in place?
Legally.
Legally.
Correct, yes. It is open to it.
Thank you.
Are you presenting any evidence to demonstrate that the effects-based approach is more efficient?
Well, this round, it's plan evidence. And then as we get to each of the site-specific submissions, depending on what is being sought for those sites, whether it's a ski field or a rural living area or the commercial overlay at Amersfield, whatever is being sought, that will be addressing the effects of the effects-based approach.
Surely if you're suggesting that strategically an effects-based approach should be taken overall because of efficiency, you would be producing some evidence to demonstrate that at this point.
We will be.
Because that's the strategic time is now, not the detailed time later.
Well, no, this is what's hard about managing a case when it's been run in this way, is that we can't turn up with several submitters of complete cases because that would take days. So we've had to focus on the planning arguments.
But isn't the big
picture?
But isn't the big picture what we're dealing with now?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And isn't that
and all of those issues come into
the
new
big picture?
But I would have had to address you on a site-specific, site-by-site basis if you wanted that evidence. And then that's our whole
I wouldn't have thought so. I would have thought there's a dichotomy between, in your submission, there's a dichotomy between an activities approach and an effects-based approach. And I would have thought if you wanted to resolve it in one way or the other, you, irrespective of the detail at the bottom, you would have suggested to us why we should choose an effects-based approach.
Well, I think that we have in Mr. Ferguson's planning evidence, because our argument is partly as a matter of principle in this district compared to the starting point of the proposed plan, which is at one end of the spectrum, we're saying allow for a more effects-based assessment to protect those values on a case-by-case basis. So that's a matter of planning principle rather than side-by-side assessment of the evidence and the evidence at this level. Okay. So I guess it's a matter of trying to find the right balance between managing four activities. So at the moment, the balance says, I think it's something along the lines of provide for farming and manage other activities. I can't remember what the quote was in the 42A report. And we're saying, well, no, that balance should be changed so that we're providing for certain effects in the non-urban areas. So not providing for more aggressively certain activities, if that makes sense. Now, I didn't have anything in particular to add under the urban development heading, just noting that there has been a change of position from the submission as lodge, which objected to UGBs, and now we're in a position where we're not opposing UGBs, but just want, we believe, that more direction of urban development outside of the UGBs would be helpful. And Mr. Ferguson's got some examples of that.
In relation to that, what do you put to you in you? Decide whether it's a legal or a planning question. So if it's a planning question, I suspect Commissioner Sinclair will have more to say about it. Isn't the concept of urban development outside urban growth boundaries a contradiction in terms? You either have a boundary within which urban development occurs and without which it doesn't occur, or you don't.
That's where we started from, that's where we started, but then realised that with not great changes to the provisions that were already in the proposed district plan, that you could still provide for urban development in a much more constrained way, if you like, outside of those urban growth boundaries, because there is, and there will be, development that can be that is defined as urban that sits outside those UGBs. And so that's what I think Mr. Ferguson has suggested some changes to just advance that a little bit further.
Well, I suppose the question is, should be.
Well, that's a question of merits, and we're saying yes to that as well.
Can you explain perhaps why you changed your position around from opposed to not opposed? Sorry, I'll come to you.
Sorry, Chris.
Your position
which was to oppose the urban growth boundaries. Primarily the reason for that is reflecting on the evidence that was prepared from the council as part of the Section 42 report. There was two lots of evidence in particular that dealt with the urban design aspects of what urban growth boundaries would result in and the urban design benefits of having urban growth boundaries. But there was also the evidence of Mr. Kastner from the council in terms of the integration of the infrastructural components to the land use, which, in reflecting on the council's wider functions and how they want to integrate with things like the Local Government Act, I think that was just caused me to reflect on perhaps what it also is meaning in terms of concerns in the submission. So perhaps it was not so much with what was the urban development happening within the urban growth boundaries. It was actually the framework which deals with the other activities that may not be urban, which occur in the rural activities that might get caught within that framework. And that goes back to the Commissioner's question before of what is urban development. And hence the importance of that definition. So I'll tease that out a little bit in my notes.
While that's in your mind, do you have any assistance to give us as to what the definition of urban development should be? Because I think the consensus of every lawyer, at least I put this question to, is the current definition doesn't make sense and is incapable of being made to make sense just by tweaking it. And it really needs to start from the from ground zero and work up.
I guess the submission from Derby Planning was not concerned with that definition of the submission on that, so that was probably taken from an informed position, having been involved with the plan change on the boundaries and urban growth. That was, I think, PC 30. And I think it was acknowledge it was a mediated outcome that provided for a definition which captured perhaps non quantitative aspects of what urban development might be, and it provided some qualitative assessments of things like characteristics of what urban development might be. So it has those components to it. The way that I approached it in the evidence was, I think that given the importance of that definition, perhaps that definition needs support from the other surrounding policies and the objectives which provide for non-urban development. So it's fine to have a definition, and that definition is primarily focused, from what I can see, on enabling and dealing with the management of urban development within urban growth boundaries. So what I'm saying is that perhaps that definition and that framework could be assisted through other objectives and other policies which help to support that definition for the non-urban development which occurs within rural areas.
One line of evidence we've received from from Millbrook, which is not currently within an urban growth boundary, make a strong play that they are not urban and they don't want to be urban. And I've read also Mr. Geddes's evidence, which will be announced today, that makes takes a similar point in relation to Jack's point, saying that the Chapter 4 policies are appropriate for Jack's point, which are interesting courts suggest a need to reflect on in Chapter 4. You said, Mr. Ferguson, that your concept of urban development is a qualitative concept. Have I got that right?
The current plan definition, which has been rolled over, if you like, from PC30, has in it subjective elements, qualitative components, which I think talks about the characteristics of that development making it urban. So it's refrained from talking about density or lot sizes to create that. And I offer probably an explanation why it is a view that is perhaps understandable, given that the regime for subdivision of development within the urban, within the rural channel zone, doesn't have a minimum allotment size. So if you use those sort of measures, you can quickly become unstuck because of the type of outcomes that you're anticipated and provided for in the rural zone. Could easily get you into what might be defined as an urban development if you start to introduce measures like density and lot size.
Putting aside the current definition, as I was saying, that there are some certain flaws, like any other document that's been the result of drafting by committee or most others. Would you say, as a planner, that focusing on the characteristics of urban development is the way to approach the question?
One way to approach it.
Is it the best way?
I don't think I can find a better way or could suggest to you a better way. What I've sort of suggested is if you focus on the type of development that you're expecting, which is not urban, and provide for and recognise what that might look like, what that's anticipated in terms of the district plan for the rural zone, I think it might help take the heat out of the debate around interpreting what urban development is. If that makes sense. So I'm sort of suggesting that it might be a two-fold discussion around the definition of what urban development is, as well as providing for and recognising what other activities which are not urban development which are expected in the rural areas.
So do you think that the heat could be taken out of it, for instance, if the plan had a definition similar to that in the operative Auckland Regional Policy Statement for Countryside Living?
That's a definition which I'm not immediately familiar with. It might be some aspects of that, if it's relating to residential development, perhaps, although I'm not sure of what goes.
Well, no, it's relating to countryside living, rural residential development. In other words, should there be a definition of the characteristics of that level of activity which is primarily residential but in rural areas to distinguish it from urban?
So having a rural setting designed to promote certain landscape outcomes consistent with the landscape objectives, for example. That hadn't occurred to me that it would be one way of dealing with one part of the development that you'd expect within the rural zone. And then you might just need to sort of, I guess, which is where I arrived at, but which is through the other policies and other objectives, recognising the other forms of development which occur in the rural zone, which might not be countryside living, such as, for example, the ski areas, with whatever infrastructure they might have. I guess that's just teasing out what other elements of development that might occur within the rural zone, which perhaps are not urban or perhaps not countryside living.
I suppose it'd be also tourism activities or commercial activities that aren't residential that are desirable to be located outside of the urban growth boundaries. So
like abattoirs.
Well, I wasn't thinking of that myself. Restaurants and function areas of work.
Are restaurants better outside of urban areas than inside them?
Presumably some of them are, as we've got at the moment.
But no, that wasn't... your statement was commercial activities that are better located outside the road boundaries.
Yes, and I think in a tourism district where the tourists are mobile, there is a good argument for those sorts of commercial activities being spread out throughout the district. Because it's not...
Randomly? Pepper Potter?
I'm not saying randomly, but there would need to be a reason, a locational reason, you know, a reason to put a particular business in a particular place, knowing the route that tourists take and what sort of client they're trying to attract and so on bridge between A and B, here's a nice place to have a coffee or a taste of some wine or watch paracopters come down or whatever the activity is. There would still need to be a locational justification for a particular commercial activity if it's not in the urban zone.
It might also be activities or developments that we have thought that will happen in 15 years' time. So I have a problem with defining urban development and anything other than urban development, because of course it's non-urban residential development, but stuff that we can't even think of now. We can't actually define it as an activity, we can really only define it by its effect.
I mean, that's right, for such a progressive innovative district, you know, it's quite likely that there will be that sort of innovation, some step change in 10 years.
So I'm wondering if you can maybe only define that this isn't what urban development is, as a qualitative / quantitative mix, whatever, and then other bias effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does make sense.
Sorry, can I just go back to the urban development? You said, Ms. Gregson, that you've got qualitative aspects to the definition, but surely there must be a quantitative measure also, because just in terms of size, it must be, from a non-expert perspective, you would think that an urban development must have some element of critical mass to make it urban as opposed to something else.
Mm.
So would it be better to have a mixed
Well, just firstly, in terms of my definition, that's not what I'm observing the qualities, if you like, or the parts of what the current definition is that's been introduced, so it's not my construction. But absolutely, I think if you can, it would be desirable to do so. It might be a scale thing, but I think ultimately that itself would have pros and cons in terms of what that might look like in terms of the threshold. And as I said, we didn't submit on that particular provision, so I haven't turned my mind to it in a great amount of detail as to how that could be there articulated. I'm sorry, but that just wasn't...
Yeah, partly I understand it.
Yeah. I'm trying to work with that and supplement that, if you like.
Yeah. Well, the next point I was going to address you on was the ski area subzones. And it's a small but important point, rather than a bigger picture issue. And that's as notified under policy 6383 and rule 6413, consideration of activities and applications in the ski area subzones excluded the objectives and policies and other provisions relating to landscape categories, because the ski area subzones are all wholly or partly within ONLs, ONFLs. Through the Section 42A report, and it may actually just be an inadvertent mistake, the rule 6413, the wording of it has changed subtly but has quite a material impact, so that instead of the it's saying that activities are subject, excluding the ONFL objectives and policies, instead it's excluding the assessment matters related to landscape classifications. So yes, you've not to take into account assessment matters anymore, but the objectives and policies and the directive nature of them at the moment, by that sudden change, all of a sudden applies to applications considered under that rule.
Ms. Galloway, stepping back from what the 42A report has done and other CalSAL and witnesses have drawn attention to that point, given the Man of War case, which essentially says first decide your outstanding landscapes, then apply the appropriate planning permission, planning regime based on that classification. Do you think there is a supportable reason to say just because the ski fields are of economic importance and are sitting there that they should not be treated as part of the O&L? Are they consistent?
Well, I think the way that what that change does is it creates an internal inconsistency, because you've got another set of provisions in the rural chapter enabling the ski area subzones and activities that are defined that are appropriate for that subzone that are going to bash heads with the objectives and policies.
I don't think that was the question.
The question is, stepping back from the inconsistencies and taking the instruction we have from the court, that we have to start with the finding of fact as to what is outstanding, and then the planning treatment in terms of Section 6B will follow from that. Is carving out areas like the ski fields consistent with that legal instruction that the High Court has given us? And if not, can you explain to me why it isn't? Because I've been struggling with this, and I've been put into a number of counsel, and I'm still waiting for a convincing answer with respect to those who have preceded you.
Well, I'm going to answer in a slightly indirect way by where we ended up assessing where the 42A report might be heading is that we would need to take a fresh look at the landscape classification of the ski area subzones, look at the level of development, look at how modified it is and how far it's moved on the spectrum of naturalness, and reassess whether it actually is appropriate that it be put in an O&L.
Isn't there a problem with that? In that the court has held, and I won't quote the case because I can't remember, that landscapes are by nature large, and I would have thought that each of the ski fields on their own are not large enough to be a landscape,
and are
within the broader landscape.
That's the very question we've been asking ourselves. Can you look at that and go, is that a landscape? Is that ski area subzone a landscape?
And I also have to say, in terms of ski fields in landscapes, it is not unusual in other parts of the world for areas which are ski fields, including towns, etc., to be recognised as World Heritage Areas, which indicates that notwithstanding the various landform alterations that are made, that the landscape has not been necessarily harmed by the ski field. Would that be a fair assumption from that?
Yes, I agree. And it's all tied. We can't sort of put each of these conversations into a box, because it's all related to the strength of the wording and the objectives and policies.
Mm.
And what we're reading at the moment is a very protective regime that doesn't, at that, particularly at the objective level, but even at the policy level, doesn't indicate what appropriate development is whilst protecting O&Ls.
Well, I was going to
because it's purely focused on the protection aspect and not the appropriateness of it. So either there needs to be, when we're talking about ski fields, either there needs to be a rejig of the explanation of appropriateness and very explicit acknowledgement that ski area subzone activities are appropriate in O&Ls. That has to be, absolutely clear on the face of it. Otherwise, that uncertainty for these, established and very important assets of the district, that uncertainty is quite undesirable.
Well, now that you've raised it, I did look at Mr. Ferguson's evidence for some indication of what could be appropriate, and I'm not sure that I found any clear explanation of what could be in the plan to suggest what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. Do you have any views?
The submission in Mr. Ferguson's evidence focuses on not all of the changes we've sought. He's appended all of the changes we've sought, but his evidence only addresses what we've considered were the critical ones for this hearing. If you were to go down the line of what I was saying just before, that's actually more of a redraft, I think, of the ONFL objectives and policies than where we currently are, because I think the best outcome is that rule 6413 goes back to its notified version. And I also am not clear, on the reading of the Arcadia submission that the 42A of Friday was relying on, I'm not clear that there's even any scope for that change to apply to scarier subzones in any event, because it was sort of in respect of, I think, rural living areas, wasn't it? Not scarier subzones. So I think there's an issue there in terms of scope anyway, regardless of the merits. If it is found that it has got scope and you prefer it on the merits, it triggers, from my point of view, quite a reconsideration of the whole framework because of the significance of those scarier subzones. In terms of your overall evaluation, getting past Section 6B.
Thank you.
Question for you. Given the guidance that we have from the Supreme Court as to what is or is not appropriate in the context of Section 6B, would it be a more fruitful line of inquiry to focus on what it is that is a minor effect, given that those landscapes have been classified as outstanding to date, with the ski fields sitting embedded within them? So, by definition, whatever's happened to date hasn't been sufficiently significant or hasn't degraded the landscape to the extent that it's no longer outstanding, which would suggest perhaps that so long as what occurs in the future is similar to what's occurred in the past, then one might similarly decide that it hasn't degraded that it won't have degraded the landscape sufficiently to be of concern. Just an idea, Peter, or ponder.
I just wonder if I can chime in. Just contemplating what the commissioner was saying before about the identification of the landscape following that war decision, and that's obviously identified first in the deal with permissions. And from my understanding, I think that war was dealing with plan change 6 to the regional policy statement. And so they were probably dealing with at that time the permissions which related to the landscape. Now, in this context, we're in a position where we're dealing with the whole of the chapter, the whole of the plan. So we're not sort of dealing with that tranche of provisions which relate to the landscape in isolation to the rest of the provisions which recognise and provide for the development of other activities in the ski areas, for example. So I wonder whether or not the two trains of thought can be parallel in terms of providing for ski area activities as well as recognising and providing for the landscapes, and it's just the policies as they have been put to provide for the activities within that landscape. And I think what was in the notified plan, I thought, did that, and hence my evidence was supportive of the structure of what was proposed.
I think that what was an issue in Man of War, because it was being dealt with in sequence, was initially the mapping, and subsequently Thumb Point Station, which Council's legal submissions referred to, deals with subdivision rules. So in the context of the mapping, the court's direction, subject to whatever the Court of Appeal may say later in the year, those appeals are heard, is that first identify your outstanding landscapes and then proceed from there, which ultimately is not that different to what Judge Jackson's court said in 1999. So I think that in terms of a holistic view, there are some issues sort of balancing up outstanding issues, but that's another issue I want to discuss with counsel about the role of Section 6B in a post-King Salmon world. So again, something to ponder.
Yes, so we're nearly on to that section of my submissions.
Just before you go there, just I have a couple of questions, if I may. In 5.3, where it talks about in the improvement of those, development and improvement of those areas should be encouraged and enabled, just in regard to the ski fields. And what, if any, should be placed on that, limits should be placed on that enablement or encouragement?
Well, is it chapter 21 when we get to that? The rural chapter is where the ski area subzone specific objectives, policies and provisions are. And so that's when we sought some changes to those provisions.
But how does that sit within the strategic purpose that we're looking at now?
Well, at the point in time where the critical Chapter 6 rule had excluded ONL objectives and policies from ski area subzone activity applications, that was how we viewed it all as fitting together. And that was what we saw as being an appropriate way when you did an overall evaluation of the importance of the ski areas. That was an appropriate approach to it. I'm not sure if I've actually asked your question. We've just gone into a chapter that none of us are thinking about too hard.
No. I'd have to say yes. What I'm trying to understand is that we're going to be putting, if there's going to be anything sitting in these chapters regarding ski fields and their fit within the landscape, I'm trying to understand how to fit within those.
Well, I mean, when you get to chapter 21 and you've settled somewhat on the overarching objectives and policies, chapter 21 will have to be evaluated in light of where those are heading. Is that those for not just ski areas, it goes for the whole rural area, obviously.
But if chapters 3 and 6, because those are the two we're dealing with, suggest in by policy direction an unlimited encouragement and enabling, how can you draw boundaries when you get to dealing with chapter 21?
If chapter 6 took that approach, you're saying?
Yes.
In my opinion, it doesn't at the moment take an unlimited, set no limits.
Well, I understood Commissioner St Clair's question as to be whether there should be any limitations on the development and improvement that is to be encouraged and enabled in paragraph 5.3. If there was a policy that purely said to encourage and enable development and improvement of ski fields in chapter 6, where would there be any ability to put a limitation on the amount of development and improvement in chapter 21?
So are you asking whether there should be more direction in chapter 6 in respect of what is appropriate and what is inappropriate in the ski area subzones?
Yes.
Right, okay.
And not just in everything below, because it applies to everything. If you think about it logically, if you are going back up to chapters 3 and 6 or 4 in respect to Irvin to provide the policy basis for the limitations or whatever you create in the zone chapters, and they have an unlimited provide an unlimited mandate in no matter what direction. That's not, that doesn't provide any assistance at all, does it? It doesn't provide any basis for the lower, lower chapters.
But by that logic, you would have to try and again anticipate every activity that might occur in the rural zone and say, for this activity, the limits are this, for that activity, the limits are that. Wouldn't, you know, you have to go again activity by activity, setting limits, which is...
I'm not sure that that's, what we want to become, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. But, I mean, we've had a lot of... submissions and evidence saying, for instance, that the objective which says protect the outstanding natural landscapes should have from inappropriate
yes.
put in there with no indication or explanation of what may or may not be inappropriate. Now, repeating section 6B doesn't actually provide any guidance when you get to the zone provisions, does it?
Unless, well, only to the extent that the zone provisions then know that they're allowed to define inappropriate in a zone appropriate kind of
but
way.
But if you didn't even have the objective, they'd still have to do it, because Section 6B says you have to do it.
But no, if the objective is a truncated version of Section 6B that seems to say...
But
no change to the outstanding natural landscape.
Well, no, well, perhaps. But we'll let Commissioner Robinson discuss King Salmon with you on that point.
Yeah, that's
going
to be
him. But if you deleted the objective altogether,
you'd have to look at part two.
That's right. Yep. And so, why would you repeat part two in chapter three or six?
Mm. Oh no, I agree that's less helpful than a more carefully crafted objective. But it's if there was a choice between objective as notified and mimicking 6B, and for some reason we didn't have the choice of an even better version, a more evolved version.
Has no one put their mind to a better wording?
I'm trying to remember how different our reading was, so you've got me on the spot here. But
I'm not sure that it's a focus in Mr. Ferguson's evidence, so it's a bit unfair to put it.
I think
yeah.
I was going to
look at
the camera and perhaps identify policy 6 through 8, which applies to commercial recreation and tourism related activities within the rural zones. And that seems to be a basis of which to provide some notational context for policy, at least for scary subzones. So it's not bereft of some framework.
Yeah, so there is some framework there.
There is, yeah.
And it may need to be teased out in other areas, because I have to confess we're looking at rather more than just commercial and tourist and operations.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty general when it talks about such activities may be appropriate where these activities enhance the appreciation of the landscapes and on the basis they will protect, maintain or enhance landscape quality, character and visual identity values. So it probably captures quite a bit in there on a pretty generic basis, but it is related to commercial recreation and tourism related activities. And also I think probably just in general terms, if we accept that the ski areas are, within the outstanding natural landscapes, they would be still subject to the higher order provisions anyway.
Well, that's
something. Yeah. Okay. Are you going to move off that?
Not yet.
No. Oh, okay.
The questions going through my mind, bearing in mind the guidance that we have from King Salmon, which, whatever else it says, seems to acknowledge or carve out an interpretation of an appropriate that provides for minor or temporary activity. past Skeffield activities haven't degraded the landscape, which seems to follow from the fact that there's still classes outstanding. Could the ski fields fit within minor, you know, temporary, well, probably not temporary because they're permanent fixtures, but certainly minor effects, if there was greater direction as to what it is about the qualities of the outstanding landscape that needed to be protected from minor adverse effects?
Maybe.
Not sure I can. the concept that's going through in slow circles around my mind is that if the, at the moment, 42 Airport suggests a reference to protect the quality of outstanding natural landscapes. And I've asked other witnesses whether that might be expanded to talk about the important qualities that make a landscape outstanding. And if the focus was on minor effects on those qualities, do you think that that line of thinking has any legs?
Potentially, because that will definitely help assessing whether or not a particular piece of development is appropriate or inappropriate. It would be inappropriate if it has a particular scale of effect on one of those identified values. It would be appropriate, at least in terms of its landscape effects, if it didn't. But you know, the devil is in the detail, isn't it? And the exercise of, you know, the practicality of doing that for the different types of ODLs, whether they're mountains or foothills or ONFs and rivers and so on, you know, the practicality of doing that. Maybe this, at this stage of the process, yes, if you were starting again, that could be a great framework.
Well, I suppose the issue is, given that we're talking about the strategic direction, is that a viable alternative strategic direction that would give greater certainty that we're not talking about an absolute prohibition, but equally we're not talking about an unconstrained encourage and enable.
I think so. I mean, I think capturing something like the values of the landscape is not a bad way to put it. It also would align somewhat with the wording that the Otago Regional Council has taken with the proposed RPS.
Can I ask, popping in there, is there any complication in the fact that we had some submitters asking for an extension of the special added ski area subzones to the access ways to them? To those subzones?
Is there a problem?
In terms of defining qualities, coming up with what.
Well, that's right, we have to consider how this works in combination with those, with that exact relief, because that is what is being sought.
And I think that, you know, if you're looking at the values of that landscape in terms of a holistic concept, perhaps for a lower order hearings, then, you know, I think it gives you the ability to think about the, you know, the connections that might be appropriate or are used. But it also might give you the way in which to think about the activities, the buildings, the structures that are within, you know, the Long Mountain facilities as well. So, and if you've got an identified outstanding natural landscape, and you are part of that broader landscape, you're not going to be carved out as a small landscape area because of the reasons that we've mentioned before. Then if you have got that modification, that degree modification anticipated by the plan or by existing activities, then the values of that landscape would be adjusted according to that frame of reference. So I think that's probably a good starting point, but that might be one way in which you can start doing that and, you know, fleshing that out a little bit further in terms of what further might be expected as well.
Your reference to the regional policy statement, was that to the proposed?
Yes. I'm looking at policy 224, which I've appended with appendix 3.
I think that that could provide a starting point, Mr. Ferguson, for some sort of policy direction at a strategic level here that might incorporate some of the elements, those other elements that you've been referring to as well, like the values that people get from the experiential values that they get from being there, etc.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's always seems a negative thing about structures and buildings, but you're right. I mean, people that go to those areas derive a value and pleasure and benefit from going to those areas, just being able to access those areas and get into an alpine area.
Well, the pleasure from punching at high speed. Head down towards an outstanding natural landscape.
Exactly. I think it's probably also on that topic and looking at the way in which the policies and objectives deal with the landscapes, the sort of key difference that we have here and what we're now talking about and what we're subject to probably further hearing would be the actual classification, identification of the landscape. So we're sort of through this process there will be in this plan identified landscapes so that is sustained through the decision making process. So we have a higher level of certainty given to the identification of landscapes and we haven't had a previous regime. And for what it's worth, I support it. I think it's a good idea to have the identifications as something that people can use the panel and as an efficient and effective way to do to manage landscapes. But I think I agree with the evidence of Dr. Lee on this, and she was reflecting on this in her evidence about the implied degree of precision which occurs within the spectrum of landscape values. And it's not, you might be drawing a line, but of course, within the landscape, it's going to have different levels of natural character, and you've decided on a line, but for better or worse, that's where it is, that's where it's shown. But then to sort of prescribe a high level of detail that hinges off that could also create some difficulties around that very concept that Dr. Reed talks about around the uncertainty of where that exact line is. So I think something like having the values of that landscape is a good starting point to be able to reconcile those sort of issues. If that's ultimately what's decided, that we identify them and put them into the planning maps.
Before I was going to touch on Section 32 before going into King 7, but should we just move on to talk about King 7 first, Commissioner Robinson, and I'll go back to Section 32.
Before you go, could you, Section 7?
Oh, yes. Existing
environment, yeah. The last part there, and in particular, does not in all instances reflect environment court case law. Just which instances were they?
Well, rather than repeating what Mr. Goldsmith said, I simply adopt his submissions. In the preceding weeks, he, I understand, has given quite detailed submissions on that point, and I definitely defer to him. So that's really what I'm alluding to in that paragraph, is actually an adoption of Mr. Goldsmith's advice to you.
So we're taking out to class the invitation, and at this point, you should feel free to defer to your learned junior counsel,
yes,
who's already addressed us on this subject, who submitted to us that there has been subsequent authority which has confined the ambit of King Salmon and the two specific instances. instances were the Basin Bridge and was it Calverley? And I've now had the occasion to read those cases, reread the case of the Basin. And as I read the Basin, it was merely saying that the findings of Supreme Court as to the circumstances when reference back to Part 2 was permissible did not apply in a designation setting where there's a specific reference back to Part 2, because Section 171 starts subject to Part 2, just as Section 104 does. I think it was upheld on that point in the High Court. So I'm not sure that that supports your argument, and Calverley, as I read it, was saying that as regards the term avoid, it took the connotation or its context, and you couldn't assume that how the Supreme Court had interpreted avoid in the context of those CPS policies necessarily applied, which is, to my mind, clearly right, given the Supreme Court itself pointed to other environment court cases in other contexts, saying, well, that might have been right in that context, but we're looking at this one. But they, as I read that decision, it was also saying that the guidance as to what was inappropriate for the purposes of Section 6B was of general application, and in fact, as the Environment Court said, was the natural and ordinary meaning of the term. So that's a long introduction to say I'm not sure that your submission is supported in the way you suggested by the cases you cited, and an opportunity for you to respond.
What's the question?
Well, the submission was that King Salmon could be confined to its facts and didn't provide general guidance on what was inappropriate.
I keep my response to that very simple. King Salmon was primarily the application of those specific NZCPS policies and what was required to give effect to those. This district plan is quite a different proposition. There's no overarching, apart from the RPS, there is no similarly prescriptive and protective overarching statutory document on Section 6B point. This district plan is not required to give effect to Section 6B in isolation of all other matters. It's an overall assessment, and Section 6B is just one of the matters that have to be recognised and provided for, which is quite different to giving effect to Section 6B in isolation. So I do maintain that we can't just apply King Salmon directly because of those fundamental differences.
Well, this is the point in Blake that you addressed later in your submissions. In terms of recognising and providing for protection of O&Ls as part of sustainable management, as the Supreme Court described, do you think that there is room for an overall judgment that, notwithstanding that O&Ls are not being protected, that is still consistent with sustainable management?
So are you asking me, does Section 6 set up some bottom lines that something cannot be crossed?
Correct. I'm not saying that proposition is correct. That's my question.
It's a big question, isn't it?
Yes, it is the big question.
Yeah.
Well, what's the big answer?
I don't think there's any case law that tells us the big answer is about definitely bottom lines. I know that a lot of people keep, in different areas of the environment keep arguing that there are some bottom lines in the Act. But,
yes, there's always finding where they are is the trick.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. you know, life supporting capacity. Well, that's the bottom line, but exactly what does that actually mean? More life or just some of it in terms of ecosystems. So, and I don't think King Salmon says there are definitely bottom lines in Section 6 is set in concrete, because it is still an overall judgment. It isn't prescriptive in that sense.
I suppose that the...
But if there were a, you know, national policy statement on landscape that we had to give effect to, that's quite different.
Yes, that would be quite a different position.
Yeah.
I suppose my question is, if it is an overall judgment, are you still recognising and providing for protection of the ONLs?
Yes, because it would be, to the extent that that recognition is one thing, that's identification, that's kind of the, well, I was going to say, the easy part of the process, but that's probably not correct, it's not easy. But the fact that at some stage in the planning process, whether it's in the plan or if you're coming to make a decision on consents and it's apparent the plan hasn't identified all of them, you do have to identify it and recognise it. But the protecting from inappropriate development, providing for that protection is influenced by the overall evaluation. It's not done in a silo because there is no NPS we can use as a touchstone here with that higher directive of good effect. We don't have that here because the RPS doesn't give us that clarity and direction.
Discussion with another witness asking, well, clearly we don't have a national policy statement on landscape, but we do have a national policy statement for freshwater management, which has been suggested to us is something that is relevant to the panel's determination and needs to be given effect to. Would that cause you pause, Gavin, in relation to the submission you made to us?
Well, I mean, I know the NPS freshwater very well, and it will be relevant at some level to this district plan. But given what it grapples with in detail, which is more quantity and quality, I struggle to see how much influence, I struggle to see how large the job of giving effect to the NPS freshwater is for this panel and this plan. Given Section 70 and Section 71 says what you can and can't take into account and what you must include within the plan and so on, you know, that means that your real ability to give effect to the NPS freshwater management is pretty limited, and it clearly does fall mainly on the regional council that duty, giving effect to the NPS freshwater management. Possibly the NPS on renewable energy's got more bite in terms of land use planning than this district, but not so much the freshwater.
And certainly Transpower made extensive submission about the NPSET.
Oh yes, of course they do, yeah.
I think you don't think that.
Sorry, voluntary.
We understand they have a mine plan right through the Cadrona and Soho. They have a mine plan through the Cadrona and Soho ski fields, from what they were telling us.
Which this plan has to give effect to. That was the only aspect of King Salmon.
I understand you're grappling quite hard with that particular question. I don't envy you. This district is being watched by other districts who have to grapple with its own too. So no pressure. So I made some points on the Section 32 evaluation. One of the points I added since submitting the legal submission is point A, just noting, and it all relates back to the same conversation, the have the appropriateness of the objectives in these chapters, have they been properly assessed through the Section 32 evaluation to give you the evidence you need to best make your decision? And so going back to the landscape, the ONFL objective, has that really been given an appropriate level of assessment to determine if it's the most suitable objective for achieving the purpose of the Act in terms of the Section 32 evaluation? So we've raised some a suite of concerns we've got with the adequacy of the Section 32 evaluation. Another thing that it hasn't done, that it should have done under the new version of Section 32, is actually quantify the benefits and the costs in terms of employment opportunities and economic growth.
Question for you.
Provision will take away.
Like a number of councils have made that suggestion, but as far as I've observed, no one else has provided any quantitative analysis of the provisions they're suggesting.
Mm-hmm. No, by all means, and neither are they required to. So if those provisions are... at the end of the day, there is a legal requirement that the council do that. There isn't a legal requirement that submitters do it. But there is a legal requirement that as the plan evolves and you make some changes, and there might be a big grab bag of different changes, that a further evaluation be done and follows that same...
Well, put it another way. If a quantitative analysis is required, and in terms of Section 32.2, and submitters haven't given us a quantitative analysis to support their own evidence, on what basis is the panel going to do one if it should find merit in the planning provisions that are being suggested by submitters?
Mm. I agree, and that's again possibly a symptom of the staged processes. At what point do we front up with the Rolls-Royce case? This is the complete package that we say the plan should be changed to reflect, and these are the costs and the benefits that we've evaluated and quantified as part of that package. I mean, it is very inefficient to turn up several times with little wee chapters of that story that really only makes sense when you tell it as a whole.
Well, I suppose we could respond to sort of almost for that submission. I mind it sort of it's left he or she who turns up without economist throw the first rock.
Yes, but I mean, all I can say is that there is no legal requirement for a submitter to do that, and it would be wrong to make an adverse finding on a submitter's relief because they haven't provided quantification.
But on the other hand, you can't make a positive finding if there isn't such quantification to support it.
But you can, because at the further evaluation stage, that work, when you come up with, well, we think this is how we want the plan to look as a package, and you know, it won't just match my submission, it won't just match someone else's submission, there will be some sort of mixture. So that sort of mutant, or highly evolved, I should say, that next highly evolved stage of the plan, as a package, we'll have to go through that further evaluation. And that, you know, because it will be a unique document that won't be identical to what was notified, and it won't be identical to what any one submitter sought, that unique package will have to go through that further evaluation.
But it can only be based on the evidence that's put before us.
There's nothing that restricts... No, there's no restriction in the Section 32A sections that it has to be based on just the evidence that was presented. A further evaluation, you can either, if you do have all the evidence you need, you can summarise that in your decision, and then that is your further evaluation. Or a separate further evaluation can be commissioned. That's exactly what the section contemplates.
I suppose the question for you is, I think where you're going with the submission is that you'll introduce chapter and verse on costs and benefits in the context of the detailed provisions. When I asked Mr. Winchester, the council, the same question, his answer was a quantitative analysis of it was not appropriate or useful in the context of the strategic chapters, but clearly there would need to be one, and the evidence would need to be produced in the more detailed chapters. Are you in the same position?
Yes,
that it needs to happen, and that it needs to happen in these more detailed chapters?
Well, it doesn't have to happen in respect of the objectives. There's no legal requirement that even the alternatives be assessed in respect of objectives, and there's no legal requirement that benefits and costs be assessed in respect of objectives. The only thing that you measure, you know, that's the only thing that you measure objectives against is the purpose of the Act and what's suitable, what's most appropriate. Then, once you've done that, and so that kind of partly agrees with Mr. Winchester in that most of the provisions we're talking about in this hearing round are objectives. They're not policies, but there are some strategic policies, overarching policies. So as soon as you get down to that policy level and the rules and the other methods, you have to look at alternatives, which is not what we're arguing about. But you have to quantify and evaluate the benefits and costs of the provision that the council was actually advocating. So
quantify if practical.
If practical, yeah. Yes, if practical. That's right. But there doesn't seem to have been an analysis even in the Section 32 assessment of these chapters of whether or not quantification was practical. It just doesn't touch on it. It's silent.
Yes, and that's why I asked Mr. Winchester the question. And he said his answer was it hadn't been done because it wasn't practical, it wouldn't have been useful.
Right. Okay.
Well, I suppose the question is, do you dispute that?
I'd have to consider that because I think that in terms of what some of these provisions do to a landowner in the rural general zone and their ability to do something other than farming, that must have been a quantifiable. There must have been some things you could quantify to say that they got the balance right with the relevant policies and rules. But I'd have to consider that further. I mean, at the end of the day, Section 32 assessment is a process, it's not a test. So I'm not saying anything rises or falls on the adequacy of it. I'm just saying we don't have all the information we need to justify, out of the Section 32 evaluation, to justify these aspects of this framework that we're seeking changes to. So, I mean, those were the main matters I wanted to, when through questioning, the main matters that I wanted to, address you directly on, I've covered. So, really, in your hands now as to whether you've got further questions for myself or Mr. Ferguson, or matters we haven't traversed.
I think it might be appropriate to hear from Ms. Hill first.
Yes. Put on your Hence and Family Partnership lens. Mm.
Just hand up these legal submissions. Okay.